Good morning, everybody. I welcome you to the Commetrics University Coffee Break webinar from July 14th, 2010. This is our number 15th in the series of webinars we're doing. So today we will talk a little bit about an issue that we have all to deal with every day, and that's particularly too much data, or data is coming out of our ears. So let me just dive into the topic right now. Deborah, of course, is no longer up. She's 9 hours behind our time. She's no longer up, but I'll take care of the webinar this time, and she'll be back in August, August 11th, when we pick up again after our summer break. So you know the drill. If you have a question or a comment, just please put it in the chat box, and you can then by Friday morning you'll get a reminder via email, tells you where you can download. You can download the webinar slides from university.commetrics.com, and you can also listen to the podcast, and there's also information about how to get it from via iTunes if you have an iPod or something else like this. Okay. So the topic today is social media manager measurement, making data work for you. And second, on our slide 3, which we're looking at right now, what ingredients help you succeed in manage too much data? Of course, our usual advice is focus on the trends. On slide 4, you see on the upper right the global information created and available storage. We already have, since about 2007, more information available than we can actually store, so a lot of it gets lost already. Some estimate that words that we produce as information make up less than 0.1% of all the information we produce. The biggest chunk comes from video and pictures and those kind of things. And then of course there's also the issue, how much of the information is original information. For instance, wire services like Reuters, Bloomberg, and so forth, and even newspapers reproduce news, meaning they take a press release and reproduce what's already on the press release. And of course, the press release is stored somewhere on the web already. But there's no data available, at least to my best knowledge, indicating about that. This brings us to slide number 5. Slide number 5 addresses kind of the scientific articles being published, and we all started out in 1990 when we started out at about 100, and as you can see, particularly in some countries like China and Brazil, the amount of scientific articles, scholarly articles being published has increased tremendously. And so now these days we are over 112,000 and millions of those that being produced. What's kind of worrisome is that the amount of digital information has a compound annual growth of 60%. So we have 60% more information each year, and that means it's 10 times more every 5 years. And this is kind of a scary thing. You can find out more about this on our slide 14, which I won't show today. So you have to download the slides, and there's some more links which actually show you what this kind of information means. This brings me to slide number 6. Whilst we have a monstrous amount of data, lots of people are only on mobile phones, and they don't really have mobile broadband. And this is kind of the challenge we have to deal with. Whilst in Europe, we'll have most people having access even from home using broadband, in other countries this is not the case. And if you have a mobile phone in Africa, as we've seen with the 2010 FIFA World Cup South Africa tournament, people have paid mobile phone cards, prepaid, and they do not have broadband internet access. And when it comes to smartphones, which is of course more in North America and in Europe and of course Japan and Korea, a lot of people use news with their smartphones. So they ride the subway or the commuter train, and they're reading the news instead of having a copy. Nevertheless, because of the speed being an issue and so on, I think it's very clever to have a web page which actually can run on a 56 kilobyte telephone modem, because users today don't wait more than 6 seconds, and if they don't get anything, they will just move on, and that's kind of a problem. So even if your connection is very fast at your company's place, that doesn't mean that some of your clients who come with a mobile connection or are in a country that does not have the same infrastructure as Europe, they may have difficulties getting it. This brings me to slide 7, and I just wanted to use one example, which is Walmart, which is the largest store chain we actually have around the world. It has 8,500 stores approximately. It has 2 million employees, and it has lots of revenue. But what's so interesting for me is that its 200 million customers produce about 1 million customer transactions each hour, and that results in 2.5 petabytes, and that's about 167 times the books that are stored in America's Library of Congress. There is a slide that explains these storage terms, and you can look at it on our slide number 17, which I won't show today, so just download and have a look. It's quite interesting. Every store, every loyalty program from a store or from an airline is producing tons of data. And the question, of course, is how do we measure that we're doing this successfully, or how do we know that the data we have is even useful? And as slide 8 actually shows, here comes the big question: are data trustworthy? There is a so-called medicine index, which tries to determine if a particular company like Novartis or Aventis or Pfizer is responsive to the needs of people in less developed countries. And when you look at the study itself, and it got published everywhere, you might have seen it yourself, the context is an issue. So they used one of the issues you always have to ask, regardless of what study is being used, including this one, is who are the respondents? Are these students? And often they're psychology students. And so the question immediately comes up: are these findings applicable to workers or to your clients? And often you have data from the USA, and the question then is, does it apply to Holland? In this particular study, the various categories used to add an index. So they make a category like price, and then they have several measures to get the price index, and then they have others one like accessibility of drugs, and they have several measures to access that. But it's not clear, and then they weigh these issues. So they say, for instance, price is 40%, accessibility is 50%, and 10% is advice to customers. I'm just sort of picking those out of the hat. There needs to be a rationale why you weigh something more than you do to others. For instance, with our indices, with my.com, metrics.com, we weigh each index the same. That in a way is a decision as well. We say none of the three indices we use is worth or more important than the other one. If you put a weight on an index, you need to know why. And you can do this in a very clever way. You make it relatively difficult. You produce 133 pages like they did, and no journalist will ever read it and go to the appendices, which are another 50 pages, to read what your rationale is. And so they will never find out that you don't really have a rationale, and that actually the findings you have could be questioned. And this is the kind of issue: how much do you trust the data you have collected? This brings me to slide number 9. So let's get into this trustworthy issue a little bit. So you could have various types of data. You could have web-based data, where you have a survey on the web to ask your clients about customer service, for instance. And that's a self-selection. Usually what happens is that the interested parties will participate, and that's fine. But what about those that were not willing or interested to answer the question? Are those all the customers that are actually unhappy with your customer service? And then you have surveys that measure attitudes versus opinions. This is very hard. It's very difficult to do. For instance, you can measure satisfaction and then link it to workers' absenteeism rates. But what do you do if you have satisfied workers that are as absent as not satisfied workers? Is then satisfaction a good measure for your company to use to gauge the work environment and the ambience in the work environment? Unless the measure you use helps you to distinguish. So for instance, if you say, if people spend more than 2 minutes on my webpage, the chances that they will actually sign up for my newsletter or talk to us about a product is 50% higher than those who go after 1 minute, why do you care about how much time people spend on your website? Those are the kind of issues you want to address. This brings me to slide number 10, and that's something people don't tend to address. What is the non-response bias? I don't know how it works with you, but I get called at least once a week by some kind of pollster who wants to ask me about what's your image about banks, or how do you feel about these types of products? And I honestly never answer. I always say thank you very much, I'm not interested in hanging up. So now the question is, am I and others who do not respond to these surveys or to these telephone interviews, are those different kinds of people? Are older people less likely to answer? Are people with higher incomes less likely to answer? Are your customers willing to answer these surveys? So you need to have a kind of a profile and gather data from people who do not respond. Because if the people who are not responding are different than the people who are responding to your survey, you may have a serious kind of problem with the data. You may not be able to generalize from the data, or your data may not be valid because it excludes possibly an important group of people you're interested to know about. So for instance, if non-response bias means that most of your more recent customers don't answer and they purchase less than those that answered the survey and have been clients for a long time, you may not have collected data that might be very important to change your marketing strategy. That brings me to the social media issue. I mean, we're talking about social media metrics. And so we have to ask ourselves, what does this abundance of data, what does this too much data mean for us in social media measurement or social media metrics? Usually we have to distinguish between two things, between easy or efficient measures and effective measures. So if I get page views from a web page or a blog, or unique visitors, that's easy to collect. It's easy and cheap. Okay, it doesn't cost me much money, it doesn't cost me time. So often we get it, but it's usually not accurate. If you go to the latest post on commetrics.com, where we talk about social media measurement to boost your ROI, we actually address this issue. We link to a story where it's explained where sometimes unique visitors may be inaccurate by 20 to 50%. Effective is a kind of a measure that measures what it's supposed to measure. So unless you have a purpose for your social media activities and you come up with a measure that relates to that purpose, you can basically not measure or can make much sense out of your social media measurement. So to give an illustration, if you have a group, if you moderate a group, like I moderate the social media monitoring group on Xing, or another one for law and social media on LinkedIn, the question is, how much benefit does that get? And how do I measure it? Do I measure it according to how members participate? Some rarely ever participate. Do I measure it with the number of people who sign up? What do I use? Those are easy measures, okay? But the effective measures really say, what do I want to gain from this particular tool? And in my case, I want potential clients and clients to gain trust to what we do. And that means a key element could be that somebody invites me to tender, which happened just last week, and that was based on the webinars and some other information they got via the group, and they said, well, we think you can do the job. So that's a kind of an effective measure, because that was the intention I had with this managing this particular group, to get people interested in the topic and of course to build a reputation and some trust, and that results to bottom line things such as getting invited to tender or getting actually a contract. So you have to put out the seeds, you have to tend the garden, you have to water it. Just look outside, it's very hot, so it needs watering at least once every day. Even your plants on your balcony do. And that's the same kind of thing with social media. From advertising, we still have this bias towards eyeballs types of measures. So that's like unique visitors to blog posts. These are efficient, but they won't tell you if you really achieve a better ROI with this particular measure. That brings me to the next one, and that's kind of the wrap up, the conclusion, slide number 12. So when you do social media metrics, you're gonna have to figure out, what's the purpose for my social media activities? What do I hope to gain from my metrics? And then you set the strategy and you check. And some other people even say, if you get results such as page views, unique visitors, or how many new customer contacts did you make, unless that results in some kind of action, maybe that measure is not even important. So your page views are higher. What does that mean? Are you going to do something about it? Is it due to some advertising or a great blog post that somebody like Reuters link to? Yesterday I had a blog post, I just discovered a blog post which I have about BP and its oil spill, and it was linked by PBS, which is the US public broadcasting system, public TV channel. They have a very popular blog about social media, and it linked to my story, and that was one explanation why the traffic went up. Unfortunately, you don't have every blog post that will be linked by some high traffic site. And even if I get more traffic from this PBS linking to my blog, or 3 weeks ago in the US Consumer Reports, which is something like Stiftung Warentest or something like that, linked to one of my stories, that's great. But besides increasing my traffic, does it increase sales? Does it help my sales? So that's the kind of the question I have to address. So here I outline on this slide number 12 that you shouldn't use more than 5 measures. So for instance, for assessing your blog, we have the Commetrics footprint index, we have a health index, and we have the Commetrics, what we call the Commetrics page rank, which is actually how big a splash your blog is making in the blog community, which then gives a composite index, which is called the Commetrics Blog Impact Index. And then usually we add 2 to those. We look at referral traffic. Referral traffic are the other sites linking to your blog. That means people who know about the subject, liking what you're writing about or the white papers you're posting or linking to. And that's kind of important, because referrals does not only affect your Google ranking either through Google's PageRank, but it also affects the traffic, because the people who come through those referrals are people who are interested in the topic you're writing about. So that's very nice. And then, of course, you also look at your URL shorteners. You may use something like bit.ly or whatever. And that tells you exactly if you feed something on Facebook or you put something on Twitter, how many people have clicked on it. And I've said last week, I commented on this, that you know you should strive to do 25%. So we have about 800 people who follow us on Twitter, and if we put out a link and we post it twice, for instance at 1 o'clock in the morning, that's 4 o'clock for Californians in the afternoon the day before, and we do it at 7 o'clock in the morning Europe time, we often get combined 200 to 300 people clicking on it without the retweet. So that means anywhere from 25 to 35% of our followers are actually clicking. So for us, that's a success, because when we look at other people's, they get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%. So this is kind of what you have to look at. And what this also illustrates, what I've just talked about, is that to get effective measures that make sense to your organizational context, to what your organization needs, is time consuming. You can't do it in 1 or 2 minutes. It takes a little bit more time than doing that. And if you have more than six, it's probably useless. So that if you have an expert, a measurement expert, he may have 20, but your top management probably doesn't want to see more than three, maybe five. I deal with clients, they don't want to see more than about four. And one of those fours has to be page views or unique visitors, because that's what they understand, and that's what the advertising agency has told them as well. But the other three are going to be more kind of metrics that make sense in the context of what they work. This brings me to the last slide of today, number 13. You know where to download the slides again. They will probably be available later today under this link. I will have to change it so you get it faster. And the upcoming webinars, and by actually Friday morning, you will get an email if you have signed up via the sign up system that will tell you where to sign up for the next webinar. It's probably going to be a button again at today's post at university.com/metrics. This concludes today's webinar about how to manage information overload. I appreciate you being here, and I wish you a nice day, and thank you very much, and I hope to see you again on August 11th when we have the next webinar. Thank you very much.